All right, we're in chapter 27, lesson number 18 in the book, page number 59. And in this case, this lesson, just like the last lesson, they put the matching in front instead of at the back. And so we'll go over the matching right quick, and then we'll continue on the discussion questions. And it says, match the following over chapter 27. So the first one is Julius.
Centurion.
Yep, letter C, found in verse number 1. Number 2, the C.
Cecilia.
Right. Yep, Cecilia. And verse 5, letter E. Number 3.
Alexandria.
Yep, Alexandria. The ship from Alexandria, the first one they got on, I believe. No, it's the second one. Sorry about that. Verse number 6. Question or number 4.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tempestuous
man. A Locridan. Yep, F, the tempestuous wind. Verse 14. Number 5, Clauda.
Island.
B, an island, found in verse 16. And then an angel.
Stood by me.
Yep, letter D. Stood by me. We found that in verse 23. As our custom has been, let us read at least part of the chapter over. And let's read verses 1 through, let me check it here, 1 through 38. So does anybody want to volunteer to read? All right, got some hard words in there in the first.
Chapter 27, verse 1. And when it was determined that we should sail to Italy, they delivered Paul and certain other prisoners to one named Julius, a centurion of Augusta, Spain. And entering into a ship of
Adramidia.
Estramidia, we launched, meaning to sail by the coast of Asia. Aristarchus, a Macedonian of Thessalonica, being with us. And the next day we touched at Sidon, and Julius contentiously entreated Paul, or courteously entreated Paul, and gave him liberty, going to his friends to raise himself. And when we had launched from thence, we sailed to Cyprus, because the winds were contrary. And when we had sailed over the sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we came to Myra, a city of Lesia. And there the Centurion found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy, and we put us there. And when we had sailed slowly in days, and scarce were covered, and scarce were come over against Cindus, the winds not suffering us, we sailed under Crete over against Salome. And hardly passing it, came unto a place which is called the Fair Havens, nigh whereunto was the city of Lycia. And when much time was spent, and when sailing was now dangerous because the fast was now already past, Paul admonished him and said unto them, Sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be the hurt and much damage, not only of the landing and ship, but also of our lives. Nevertheless, the centurion believed the master, the owner of the ship, more than those things which were spoken of. And because the evidence was not commodious to winter, and in the more part advised to depart thence also, if by any means They might attain to a famous Lycia there to winter, which is in Haven of Crete, and lie toward the southwest and northwest. And when the south winds blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing pinnace, they sailed close to Crete. But not long after there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Eurotheion, and when the ship was caught and could not bear her up into the winds, we let her cry, and running under a certain island, which is called Paulia, we had much work to come by the boat, which when they had taken up, they used helps undergirding the ship, and fearing lest they should fall into the quicksands, straits the sail, and so were driven. And we being exceedingly tossed with the tempest, the next day they lightened the ship. And the third day we cast out with our own hands the tackling of the ship. And when neither sun nor stars in many days appeared, and no small tempest lay on us, all hope that we should be saved was then taken away. But after long absence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, "Sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me, and not have loosed from Crete, and to have gained this harm and loss. And now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall be no loss of any man's life among you but of the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve, saying, Fear not, thou must be brought before Caesar, and lo, God hath given thee all of them that stand with thee. Wherefore, sirs, be of good cheer, for I believe God that it shall be given as it was told me. Howbeit, we must be cast upon a certain island, but when the 14th night will come, as we were driven up and down in a drill, about midnight, the shipmen deemed that they drew near to some country, and sounded and found it 20 fathoms. And when they had gone a little farther, they sounded again and found it 15 fathoms. Did you say 28, verse 28?
38.
38. I thought I tortured you about it. Then, fearing lest we should have fallen upon the rocks, they cast 4 anchors out of the stern and wished for the day. And as the shipmen were about to flee out of the ship, when they had let down the boat into the sea, under color as though they would have cast anchors out of the foreship, Paul said to the centurion and to the soldiers, "Except these abide in the boat, ye cannot be saved." Then the soldiers cut off the ropes of the boat and let them fall off. And while the day was coming on, Paul besought them all to take heed, saying, "This day is the 14th day that we have carried and continued fasting, having taken nothing. First of all, I pray you to take some meat, for this is for your health, for there shall not and hair fall from the head of any of you." And when he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in presence of them all. And when he had broken it, he began to eat. Then were they all of good cheer, and they also took some meat. And we were in all in the ship 260 souls. And they that had eaten enough, they lighted the ship and cast out the wheat into the sea.
All right, thank you for reading that. If you look in the Pew Bibles there, the last page, it's second to the last map. This didn't happen to be ripped out. You have a map of the journey. The little, in the corner page, little square there, they said Paul's, it's titled Paul's Journey to Rome. You'll find a little map there that, if you can see it, it's pretty tiny of where all they went. They're, you know, jumping from here to there into the sea when they cut loose. You kind of see what happened to them. You know, getting to the island there of Malta, that is showing that they're off course big time. As they're going, when they cut the ship loose, that's where the wind took them. And so this is getting to be an exciting an exciting journey. It took them, hey, you got a color one in your Bible, hadn't you? And you can kind of see from where they're showing the wiggling around that there was some trouble. Because normally, if you look at other maps, you know, where they put all the missionary journeys around, you'll see that there's more straight lines of where they just cut across the sea there, the Great Sea or the Mediterranean Sea. And made it to these places a lot quicker. I'm thinking that after they started this journey, there were probably people there that wished they'd went by land. Because you could go by land, it would just take you longer. And this was a common route. Anyway, I thought I'd point that out to you, or you could kind of follow along if you wanted to see the map. On our thought and discussion questions on page 59, it says, into whose hands was Paul delivered for the voyage to Rome?
Julius,
verse number 1. Julius, a centurion of Augustus' band. Next part of the question is, who were two of Paul's companions on this trip?
Mark and
Aristarchus. Yeah. Yep, that hard word to say. How do we get that the other guy was on there? Because Aristarchus is mentioned by name. How do we figure out that there's somebody else? That's not one of the questions, by the way.
Explain your question.
How do we know that they're who the other person is?
Who was the other person?
Luke.
Luke?
Remember, Luke's the writer.
Yeah.
Yep. Remember who's been with Paul the whole time?
He said Mark. I know.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying prove your answer. Because I might have missed something. All right, verse number 2.
It says we.
We, there you go. This is one of the we passages.
Mm-hmm.
The we passages in the book of Acts. Whenever there's a we passage, whenever we did something, as they're narrating, that is almost always Luke.
So we is equal to Luke.
In the book of Acts, yep, because he is the writer. He is the one writing this down. I missed that the first time. I couldn't find. I was like, where's the other person? What are they talking about? And then finally caught the we right there.
Well,
read right over it.
Finished your lesson on the true and false.
Yep. That's it. That's what cued me in was the true false.
Because
I got to thinking about it. I was like, okay, there's something in there. So I went back and started reading, and I caught the we that time. Yep. Yep, there's another we. We landed. What's the significance of Aristarchus?
He may have some different information, but in the reading, the writers that I read said that there's not anything in here that says that he was actually a Christian, and he was somebody that was taking care of Paul.
Well,
and I don't know how they determined that he wasn't a Christian.
Well, I don't either, because was he not on the third missionary journey with Paul? You know, I believe that's right. He was, Some believe he was, we know he was of Thessalonica because it tells us, but some have defined him as a Christian of Thessalonica, and he was with Paul on the third missionary journey. So
they went a little further and said, at this time, or about a short period previous to this, Paul had inherited some money. How they got that and where they got that from, I don't know. And they said that they thought that Paul paid this guy to go with him and take care of him, that inheritance.
I guess it's not out of the realm of possibility.
But there again, I'm hoping that you know something about that or read something about it.
Other than what you're saying, no. I think he probably was a Christian. I don't see how you could not have trailed this whole time and not been convinced.
I just think he would have heard too much preaching.
Yeah.
Not teaching. Not to be a Christian.
And the evidence he'd seen. If he's been with Paul all this time through these rounds, he's witnessed the persecution. He's witnessed run and hide and the trials and things of that nature. It'd be hard to say there's not something to this.
Just the things that happened on the ship.
Definitely.
Where Paul told him, you know, as long as everybody remains on the ship, nobody will
perish.
Right. Except the ship. And for him to see that and just to think that the people that were on the ship proved to appreciate Paul and they listened to him, he became a very influential factor.
The next question is what shows the friendly attitude of the centurion towards Paul?
He let him visit his friends.
Yep. He let them be with him. And now they're on, this comes from verse 2, they were entered into a ship of Adramidium. That one's hard for me to say. We launched, they sailed to the coast of Asia, and then that's where Aristarchus, a Macedonian Thessalonica, being with us. The next day they're at Sidon, and that's where Paul is given liberty to see his friends. The next part of the question is, why did they sail under Cyprus?
They said the winds were contrary.
So yep. Well, have you ever been fishing in a regular boat when the winds is blowing? Sometimes if they blow in the wrong direction, you can't stay off the bank. Unless you're anchored, the wind will just blow the boat up against the bank. It's going contrary to where you want to go. And then if you're like in a sailboat situation, they throw the sail up. You're at the mercy of the wind. If it's blowing in the wrong direction, you're not going to throw the sail up because it will take you the wrong way. So
the winds have more power than what you can control.
In these kinds of ships, yes, because they don't have motors in them. Right. They don't have that kind of power. Mm-hmm. The power is going to be somebody with a paddle, or you're going to do it with a sail. Remember, too, think about this, how big these boats are. This is not a 50-foot boat. It's probably much bigger than that because you got 276 people on this thing. Think about that, just to put that many people. It's, you know, it may be 7,500 feet long or longer. Also remember, we're toting goods on this too. It's not an empty ship. It's not just full of people and it's just travelers, because what do we dump out? On further down, a little further, or right at the end of the reading, what were they doing before they try to run it up the delta or whatever into that place, huh? They throw the food, they throw the weed off. And so chances are they were shipping that somewhere as well.
These ships, I'd say, were pretty large. And the prisoners, if I understand it correctly, from history, they were actually chained on board on the deck.
Yeah.
They weren't down below was where all the goods and things, the wheat stuff. This was a cargo vessel.
Yeah, because you wanted that stuff below so it wouldn't get wet
and
get messed up.
That area that it sailed from was where they grew all the wheat. It was a farm.
You want to see? You want, the number three, in what ship did Paul begin the journey? Nope, that's the second one. Alexandria is the second one. The first one is, Adramidium. That's the first one. There's a trick question there, wasn't it? I think he asked that question so he'd go back and read it. Where did he change? In Myra, verses 5 and 6. They sailed over to the Sea of Cilicia and Pamphylia and came to Myra. So that's where they lit, a city of Lycia. I guess that's how you say it. And there they found a ship of Alexandria sailing into Italy. There's where the grain hauler is, the big ship. And he was put therein. I'm going to venture out and say that the prisoners and Paul and the ones going to see Caesar was probably the smallest group on the ship. I'm going to say that the workers were probably the biggest group on the ship because of the kind, what it was doing. People to work the work everything, the people to take care of the load and so forth. Question number four is why did they make such a little progress for several days?
Because the winds were so bad.
Yep.
They were contrary to them.
Yep, they was not working with them. They were working against them, the wind was. So because of this, they were not able to make much headway. This is obviously going to turn into a problem for them because now we're getting into the wrong time of the year to be sailing a ship. Where did they finally stop and spend much time?
Fair Havens.
Yep, Fair Havens. Yeah, Lycia is the next town over. It got me the first time. We look at verse number 8. It says, "And hardly passing by, they came to a place which is called the Fair Havens, close or nigh, whereunto was the city of Lycia." Or Lycia, not Lycia, Lycia, L-A-S-C-A. So that was the town that was near the Fair Havens. The first time it got me, the first time I read that, I said, oh, it's Lycia. And no, I believe the right answer is the Fair Havens. The next question is, what admonition was given by Paul at this time and why? Yep, verses number 10 and 11. Sounds pretty bleak there, doesn't it? Doesn't sound too good. He gives them the warning. Gives them the warning there, the admonition given. There'll be much hurt and much damage. But Paul's not a sailor. But one thing they didn't understand, or some of them probably did, but most of them evidently didn't understand, was Paul had a higher power working for him. He had something better going on than somebody's gut feeling or experience. And who did they believe, the centurion believe?
The master and the owner of the ship.
Yep, the master and the owner of the ship. He thought, well, he must know better. He was probably the experienced one. And I've thought about this and thought about it a little bit. You keep seeing these delays happening through the story. They're trying to get somewhere, the wind doesn't work for them. They spend some time here because they're waiting on stuff to get better. And then they move on. They keep pressing on when they should sit still, or at least till the season is right. And so I've thought about it, and I'm thinking, well, looks like what is happening is they're ending up into a time of year to where it's not good for them to even be out on the sea because of the wind, because of what's going on there. And notice they're trying to beat wintertime. They're trying to get ahead of it. They're failing. They're not making it. They get further behind. They're not getting ahead of wintertime there, as they're trying to do. And I guess the reason I'm stopping to say all that is Paul, or God, is about to show them something. He's about to show them that Paul is my servant. Listen to him. And as the story goes, we'll see them turn and start to listen to him, because they're like, uh-oh, he's got the ear of God, or God's got his ear, one of the, whichever way you want to look at it.
I've got a question.
Yes, sir.
One guy that I read said Paul, when he was talking about these matters, that he didn't do it through inspiration. He did it through his opinion. And I find that to me to be ridiculous, because God, that we see where the angel appears to him and these other things, and if it was just his opinion, then his opinion wasn't any better than the master.
That's right. And it seemed that Paul knew exactly what was going on because of the angel, because God. But we got to remember too, this is not the first time that's happened in this story. Did we not see him, an angel of the Lord, come to him in a dream or a vision? Did he not see that? It said, hey, you're going to be okay. And not another time we see him get the message that, you know, after he gets that, the first time we see it, after he gets that severe rejection from the Jews, to where he's like ripping his clothes and stomping off, mad, because nobody will listen. And I believe it was the angel of the Lord says, don't worry about it. Got you back. Do not fear. The ultimate fear, faith over fear statement. Don't worry about it. God's got you back. So here we see it a third. We're going to see it when we get to it. We're going to see it a third time in the book of Acts. So I don't see how that guy is right about that.
I couldn't.
It's like the evidence. To me, the evidence is not there to support what he's saying. The evidence is more there to say that it was in inspiration.
Divine inspiration.
Yeah, divine inspiration, because of the divine intervention the whole time. No, they're talking about cold weather.
That's north of Africa and in the Mediterranean.
It's not always sunny. some of those areas, they get, you know, they're going, they don't, it might not get as cold as we'd see it, but if you look at a map, we're way up north. We're north, you know, we're across from Egypt. This is, you know, you got Egypt and you got all this, you know, stuff in here. It's way north. I don't know. I hadn't never looked at or studied enough to see how much snow or whatever they get, but I know some of those areas do get snows and stuff like we do. They get lake effect, or I guess sea effect things that come in, moisture fronts and all that stuff. That's what makes some of those areas so lush and green, you know, is because they get that kind of weather. You know, that's bringing stuff up, mist and stuff off the ocean, or the sea, I guess, in this case. Well, think about it. Chapter 28, I guess, is where it's at. Chapter 28, what are they doing? They're building a fire to keep warm. They're putting on clothes to keep warm in chapter 28. What we get down to? Number six? Yep. Why did they decide to leave the Fair Havens?
They couldn't winter there.
Yep. Wasn't suitable to spend, to winter there. So I wondered if it's because of the wind. Is it because it gets ridiculously cold of stuff coming off the sea? There's something that's not good with the weather to stay there. So it's kind of like forcing their hand to move on. Where do they plan to spend the winter? Yep, Phenice, Phenice. They plan to spend it there. And number seven is what arose soon after they began the trip to the Fair Havens? Yep. How did it start out, though? Didn't it say something about a soft wind? It's kind of like you're tricking you, sucker punching you. Eulichridon, or I'm not sure how to say it. The meaning of that word, remember, this is not a place. This is defining a thing or something that's going on, an event, weather event. And if my source is right, this is a southeast wind that stirs up the waves. I could imagine it'd be the wind. It'd be like white capping the water. We know it's something that's rough. I've thought about, some of the things we've seen, seen in movies and stuff. Would it be waves of where the lift the boat up, and then you see a wave come, and then it slides down the wave, and it's leaning into it, and hits the bottom and scoops up water and comes back up right. That's the kind of thing I think we're seeing here. Really nasty shipping weather. Sailing weather.
Have you ever read about the U.S. Navy over in the South Pacific when they got caught in that typhoon?
Tell us about it.
My uncle had an uncle that was involved in that, and he said that the ships, about naval ships and things, you were not allowed to be on deck unless you were tied. You had to have a rope tied. And he said, the waves are so big that when the bow boat would go into the wave, it would go completely under. And said the only thing would be is a cutting tower would be above water. And he said, he'd sit there and think, it ain't gonna make it. It ain't gonna make it. And he said, about that time, the bow boat would go up out of the wave. And then he said, they'd try to crest the wave. And he said, you'd think, it's not going to make it. It's not going to make it. Because the propeller, if you were in a position to see, the propeller would be spinning out of the water. They'd try to press weight. And he said, about that time, the bow of the boat would go down in a sweep. And he said, it would hit so hard that you'd think, it can't stay together. Can't stay together. And he said, then it would do it all over again.
Now, all you're doing is holding on. That's a good point you bring up about the being tied in order to be out. Because usually when you're in that kind of weather and seas, if you get swept off, they're not going to find you.
Right.
You're gone.
If somebody had to be out on deck, he said, they had to be tied.
Yep. And probably the same thing here. Or at least a similar situation when this wind gets into it. Once the wind struck, what course of action did they follow?
Well, it said we let her drive. I mean, does that mean like you just let go of the wheel and let it go?
Yep, that's more or less what it means.
No, you have no control, so you just let it go.
The wind's gonna just let the wind take you where you go. Yeah, but there's two reasons. There's a good reason for that. The first reason that I know of or can think of, because of what the reaction is a little later, is if you try to hold it and go against it, like if they throw anchors in and all that, you'll probably sink the ship because it's going to be lifting up. And if you're not careful and you do it at the bottom when you anchor and then it pulls over, then it may fill you up with water because you're holding yourself down. Another reason they would cut it loose is to keep from tearing up the ship, tearing it apart. You got to remember, this is not modern shipbuilding here. This is probably most likely some kind of wood vessel of some kind. And the reason I say that is because a few verses down, it says they took helps. They tried to reinforce the bottom of the ship with helps. That means a help would be something like a stick. They took timbers, beams, and they put them across the ship to try to keep the thing from folding up. That's one kind of help they had. Another kind of helps, perhaps this would be like your rings that they would be trying to hold apart. Then in between, sometimes they would put other helps in there to keep from of the span between the two, to keep from breaking the boards in the middle from the violence of the waves. So they're in trouble. If they're going to this extent to try to save the ship, they're in trouble. As we'll read on, they make it through it. You know, they make it through that part. I'll start to say just fine. That's not right either. But they make it through it. Next page, page 60, number 8, is what were the quicksands which they feared, and where were they located?
The quicksands were on each side of the Mediterranean. And you may have a different opinion, but from what I kind of read about is it was they moved around over to the shore. But the depth of the water was not so great that they couldn't get stuck in.
Yeah, say they're 2 feet below the water or something. Obviously, you can't get across that when you're probably a ship like that's probably sitting 10 or 15 feet underwater, maybe more. These quicksands, it's sand that it's unstable. It's in the water, so therefore probably liquefaction of the soil or the sand was real easy, so probably stepping in it, it'd just fold in with you. Or if you run a ship in it, it would probably like suck it down with it, you know, kind of stick it in, perhaps even suck it down into it somewhat as the soil would be breaking apart because you set a ship on it. Next part of this question, number 8, is what did they do to lighten the ship?
They threw the cargo overboard.
Yep.
Wouldn't that be the ropes,
everything? Yep. Yep, that's what the tackling would be. Number 9 is what was their attitude after neither sun nor stars appeared for several days?
All hope was taken away.
Yep, all hope was taken away. It's like, we're not going to make it. That's the way it comes across. What assurance did Paul give them at this time?
There would be no loss of life.
Yep, there would be no loss of life. They would survive. They would survive. I think I'm going to stop us here at this question, at this one, and pick up with number 10, because I think we'll have some good discussion there brought about by question number 10, some application. Does anybody else have any comments or questions as we end this evening?